Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a little curveball for you. Normally, we hear from American veterans of World War II, and yes, this man did wear a U.S. Air Force uniform during the Korean War, but in World War II, he was flying single-engine jets for the Germans.
I think we all knew what being scared meant.
Don't miss this Only in America story, and find out when you can meet him by listening today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown. Hometown Heroes.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. You probably listen to us on 580 AM every Saturday at 1, maybe on our FM station 105.9 at 5 o'clock on Saturday evenings, or maybe you're one of those from around the country who finds us online at kmjnow.com. No matter how you find the show, I think you're going to really be captivated by the story we're going to hear today because it's unlike any other we've heard on Hometown Heroes. Each story is unique, and the idea is that no matter how big or small your hometown may be in this great country of ours, there are people living around you that have some pretty good stories to tell, stories about what they've done for the sake of freedom, what they've been through. And the gentleman joining us today has been through a lot. Harold Hal Bauer lives in the hills above Atascadero now, but wait till you hear where he's from originally. He's a veteran of World War II and the Korean War on two different sides of those conflicts. This is going to be pretty interesting. Mr. Bauer, how are you doing today?
Pretty good, thank you.
Are you looking forward to this air show in a couple weeks?
Yes, sir. It's just a fascinating experience to talk to people and to share some of the events of the past with them and make sure that everybody understands that my story can only be told really in America because it could only happen in America that a former enemy gets a chance to advance in this country and build himself a career and now being asked to talk to a broadcast station about his background.
Yeah, the tables are turned on you because I know you were in the journalism field for many years, and I'm going to grill you with the questions today. But this air show we're talking about is coming up September 29th in Paso Robles. It's at the Estrella Warbirds Museum, or at least put on by that great museum, at the airport in Paso Robles. There'll be some terrific airplanes from the World War II era and more recent. You can even see a P-38 flying. That's pretty rare to see these days. So Mr. Bauer and his wife are going to be there that day on September 29th. They'd love to meet you. And after you hear his story today, I'm pretty sure you're going to want to head down to Paso Robles or up to Paso Robles, depending on where you're hearing us from today. And Mr. Bauer, I know you've heard the program before, and you probably know that I always ask World War II veterans about December 7th, 1941, because from an American perspective, that's when the war started. But you weren't in America, and for you, the war started a lot earlier. What was your...
September 1, 1939.
September 1, 1939. Yeah. And where were you?
At that time, I was 11.
You were 11 years old.
Yeah.
In a big German family.
Yeah. We were five brothers and sisters and mother and father. All of a sudden, life changed sort of overnight.
And your father was a doctor, correct?
Our father was a doctor, but he had one of Hitler's aides died. The story goes, one of Hitler's aides died under his knife as a surgeon. So they said, married to an American lady, trained by Jews, unreliable, and they made him, gave him a rifle and made him an infantryman. And a couple of months later, in 41, he was killed on the Eastern Front as an infantryman instead as a doctor.
Wow. So you had been exposed, I guess, a little bit to the idea of America because your mother was the son of an American diplomat?
Yeah, mother was born in New Rochelle, New York. And grandfather was the American chargé first at the original house of the British royal family in Sachsen, Coburg-Gotha, and then was transferred as chargé to Berlin for a while.
Wow, quite the history. And quite the story we're going to hear today from Harold Bauer. He is 84 years old, soon to be 85, has made his home for quite a while now along the Central Coast in the mountains above Atascadero. He's going to be there at that air show in Paso Robles September 29th if you want to meet him. And you're probably wondering, hey, wait a second, I thought these were all American World War II veterans that we hear from on this show. Well, just wait till the end of the story. We'll get to that side of things. So here you are, 11 years old when the war begins in Europe, and living in Germany, being young and impressionable. How real was this presence of Hitler and the Nazi regime and this idea, this lifestyle, this movement that was taking over Germany? How did that impact you?
Well, we were, I think we were fortunate that our mother was American, and therefore there were, and father was, as I said, a doctor, and then obviously an intelligent man, and mother, they saw to it that the worst of all was sort of softened for us, that we didn't feel the full impact, while of course we heard every day on the broadcast and in the newspapers the propaganda by Joseph Goebbels and people. But we were, on the other hand, we were still young, and our main objective, or the parents' main objective, was that we went to school and try to learn what one had to learn in school. And that's sort of how the war started in 39. And of course, father immediately was sent away into the military, and so mother was there to raise five kids and try the best to bring us up properly.
I can't imagine what that must have been like and how jarring that experience must have been, but I'm sure that you found strength from your siblings and your mother.
Yeah, very much so. And grandmother, who was also American, had moved back to Germany, or had moved to Germany, and sort of was another anchor to tell us stories from real life, like meaning American life and life outside of the Third Reich atmosphere.
And I have always wondered what that must have been like. And I've spoken to some people who grew up in that atmosphere. And, you know, wartime happenings are one thing. But it seems like it must have been awfully intimidating, awfully frightening to be alive in that part of the world at that time. Am I exaggerating with that?
I can't say, because we were really too young to experience the whole impact of the war, and the big, we were still kids, really. And the only thing that had an impact, that certain things that were normal, all of a sudden you couldn't purchase all kinds of goods anymore, and you had to have stamps, food stamps, to purchase them. And mother and I was the oldest, we went out with a little cart to a ranch that was nearby, or a farm, a domain, as they call it, that grew veggies and potatoes. And mother to talk to the owner, and we got an extra ration of potatoes that we put in a little cart, and then we put it up to the house. We had maybe an extra ration of potatoes, and as you know, potatoes in Europe is sort of a main staple other than bread, you know. So we at least had, I can't say we went hungry, because in the early years of the war, mother had a good hand in making things stretch out. And so I can't say that we were hungry or deprived of specific things, because we were too young to have ever enjoyed anything different.
Gotcha. I don't know if you can answer this question either, but the other thing I've wondered, and when people look at that time in history, there is so much attention paid to the propaganda machine and Goebbels and what they were able to do, how they were able to get that nation to where it was through deception or any other means. Was it hard to, looking back now, do you think you had an accurate view of what was happening Or did that propaganda just supersede everything else?
I would say from hindsight and recollection, sort of, I think propaganda and the machinery of the Third Reich, especially after the war started, sort of took over everything. And the news, when you listen to news, it was all transformed or slanted to the war effort. And of course, as you can appreciate it, in 1939, when the German army went into Poland, I mean, there was one victory after another, and so you heard the fanfares on the broadcast station, announcing another victory and something. So, but a lot of it, as I must say now, is hindsight, because we, all of my brothers and sisters, we were too young to really understand the implications of all of this, except to realize that Dad wasn't around anymore, so that Mother had to carry the whole load.
And when you got the word that your father had been killed in the war on the Eastern Front, what did that do to you? How did you handle that news?
Well, it was numbing, but really, I don't know whether you can, as a kid, you can really understand. Of course, Mother said he got killed doing his duty and what have you. And I don't think it doesn't get through to you what tremendous blow that is, because Mother took the blow and she tried to shield us to the best of her ability from the full impact. So we were, Dad will not come back, but it didn't sink in, because the war was still going on and lots of other fathers and people were still out there fighting or engaged in war effort, and they weren't coming home either at that time, So, and then at night, of course, the air raid started and the bombing started, so you really were focused on other elements of life at the time, I think, than constantly thinking that your dad wouldn't come back. It's been a long time, and I don't know whether the brain registered in those days, really the whole impact of what had happened to the family.
Sure, and when you have air raid sirens going off every night and all those other things to distract you, you don't have time to dwell on that.
No.
You mentioned a couple times, you were just a kid.
Yeah.
And you were.
And all we try to go to school, and we're, Mother made sure we wore, scrubbed it clean, and wore clean clothes and did our homework. That was the principle of the household, so to speak.
And when did homework turn into the work you had to do for the Third Reich? Because we know that children were called into action very early,
well,
the Hitlerjugend and all the images.
After Father was killed, I finally got a scholarship to a military school in Potsdam, outside Berlin, through the intercession of some family friends. And that school was originally created by King Frederick the Great for the sons of fallen soldiers. And I got a scholarship to that school, became a uniform member of that school, which is like a military school in the U.S., like Virginia Academy, Military Academy, and we were fortunate that the officers in charge of the school were really, they at muster didn't say Heil Hitler, they said good morning, ma'am. Mm. And we were sort of brought up in the traditions of King Frederick the Great, rather in the military sense, rather than in the political sense.
Well, and that, I don't think people would expect to hear that. It's a little ironic that here at a military school, you maybe had the eye of the storm or
well,
a break
that
from
they
that.
Had our commanding officer was a pilot, World War One, highly decorated World War One pilot. And the instructors were military officers that fitted into the program. And if you recall, within the German High Command, I think there was always a section or a draft of old-time military officers that had totally different ideas than Nazi-type officers, if you will. And I think we were fortunate that our instructors were old-time military officers with different ideas than the Sieg Heil-type Nazi officers in the other parts of the German armed forces.
So is it fair to say maybe that your schooling and training there was more toward the practical and technical end of the spectrum than the brainwashing and propaganda?
We had all the basic drills, and we did sports and history lessons. But the history lessons that went way back, as I said, to the old German Reich under Bismarck and the Kaiser, rather than under the history under the Nazis. And you know, Potsdam was a very traditional old town where Frederick the Great spent his life. So I think some of the traditions of Potsdam itself as a city dated back to 18th century, you know. So therefore, it was sort of a different platform, let's suggest, that where we grew up in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, this is just a fascinating story. We need to catch our first commercial break here. When we come back, we're going to hear more of Harold Bauer's journey from a child in the German army and eventually flying for the Germans in World War II to everything he's done for America since then. And I think you'll hear how much he loves America. You've already heard him say his story could only happen because of America. It's a really different twist today on Hometown Heroes, and we'll get more of it when we come back on KMJ. That bed, I heard my wife say, in a way that I knew she was either really, really happy or really upset. Paul Leffler here for Sleep Retreat, and if it had been the latter, I wouldn't be telling you about it. No, she was excited. That bed, she said, is so comfortable. She had just gotten her first taste of our new Tempur-Pedic mattress from Sleep Retreat, Fresno's only premium bedding store. And I'm not making this up, she didn't want to move. That's how much she loves the comfort and support that Tempur-Pedic's technology delivers. This is not one mattress fits all. The trained professionals at Sleep Retreat can walk you through the whole spectrum from soft to firm. But the one thing all the Tempur-Pedics have in common is they adapt to your exact shape to support every part of your body. If you've slept on a conventional mattress your whole life, like I have, this is something you've never experienced before. Do yourself and your sleeping habits a favor by trying out the most recommended bed in America. Visit your Tempur-Pedic Comfort Center in Central California. That's Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture. For years, Paso Robles has been known for the Mid-State Fair and its world-class wineries. Coming Saturday, September 29th, a new event will join those two. Estrella Warbird Museum, in conjunction with the Plains of Fame Air Museum, presents Warbirds Over Paso. Thrill to the roar of P-51 Mustangs, a P-38 Lightning, F-4U Corsair, and even a North American B-25 Bomber. Tour the C-47, a true veteran of World War II, and see many more in breathtaking flybys. See the world's only N-9M Flying Wing, forerunner of the B-2 stealth bomber. Warbird rides available before and after the flying display. Gates open 8 a.m. Admission $20. Active duty military and kids under 12 free. Admission includes open house at the museum, free parking, food and beverage vendors on site. Sponsored in part by Firestone Walker Brewing Company, it's Warbirds Over Paso, Saturday, September 29th at the Paso Robles Municipal Airport on Airport Road off Highway 46. Call 805-277-0440 or go to ewarbirds.org/airshow.
On the front line of freedom, you are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Going to continue now with 84-year-old Harold Bauer of Atascadero. You'll have a chance to meet him September 29th in Paso Robles at the Great Air Show put on by the Estrella Warbirds Museum in conjunction with the Planes of Fame Museum from down in Chino. Some of those great airplanes are going to be there. You can see a B-25 like Jimmy Doolittle flew, a P-38 like the famed ace Dick Bong flew in World War II, and many, many more. You can also meet Harold Bauer and his wife, Margie. And he's glad he ever had a chance to meet Margie, because during World War II, you've heard him tell the story, a child growing up in Germany with five brothers and sisters. His father was killed early on in the war. And then he was sent to a military academy in Potsdam, and that's where we left off. Now, by this time, did you have any idea? Did you have these ambitions to maybe fly planes at some point?
I was flying gliders since age 9.
Wow.
And before the war started, I tracked on weekends, tracked up a steep mountainside, and we carried the simple gliders up there on rollers. And then we did our first hops in very simple gliders. There were a seat in plywood, and the wings were above you. And you had five and six guys on the right-hand side and five and six guys on the left-hand side on a rope. And they ran down the hill and pulled the ropes tight, and two guys in the back held the plane down. And then when the rope was tight, you said, go, and the guys in the back let the plane go. And you then all of a sudden were airborne, and you try to keep the plane level and try to reach the ground below in a straight and level way. And then you carried the plane back up the hill and did it again.
And that takes a lot of faith.
and of course, that all came to a pretty quick halt in 1939 when the war started, because then the whole shift was toward, finding pilots in the long range. You know, we didn't have any more time out at on Sundays at the mountain. We were then in school and trying to advance in school. And when I was transferred to Potsdam, then I was detached at times for advanced glider training with more advanced gliders that were first towed up by auto winches. And then we flew, try straight line flight and learned the basics of glider flying, wind and currents and so forth. And that went on pretty much from then on in various sort of periods of the year that you were then got detached from whatever you were doing to advance glider training. And that also went on when at age 15 there was a law in Germany that said to free any aircraft personnel to frontline duty, all male high school students had to man the any aircraft batteries around their hometowns. And since by that time I was, as I mentioned, in Potsdam at the military school was, we had our hometown was really the military school, so they attached our unit to the eastern defense perimeter of Berlin, and our anti-aircraft battery was stationed on the east side of Berlin, and we reported at age 15. We then reported to the barracks at the anti-aircraft battery. We left Potsdam and were barracked at the battery on the eastern side of Berlin. The Brits at night and the Americans later on by daytime. We went into action, and as soon as we went back to, when the alarms were finished, then we went back, and in daytime our teachers had gone, there were military officers that had gone along, and then we had to do our academic studies, all during the daytime or in the afternoon, until the next alarm came, and then we had to run out and do our duties at the battery. And as soon as sleep was short, but studies were long.
Wow. And I'm sure if there are some 15-year-olds out there listening, they're saying, holy cow.
Yeah.
They're thinking about playing football or basketball or wrestling or running track or swimming or something. But
right,
your extracurricular.
That was not available anymore. Pretty. All of a sudden.
Your extracurricular activity was shooting at American and British airplanes.
Yeah, more in the beginning, more British, until the 8th Air Force really increased their activity over Germany. And then, of course, they came in unending streams, during the daytime. The Brits came at night, and the American 8th Air Force came during the daytime. So while in Berlin in the beginning was not too often a target, but we then were transferred to the Baltic port of Stettin, which had hydroelectric facilities, and of course Peenemünde, the rocket base, was within the Stettin defense perimeter. So we were then manning a battery at Stettin, and that was became more hair-raising as months went by, you know, because then you had bombing raids day and night, you know, one after another almost. And in between, we then had to go into Stettin, sometimes it helped out the clean out the rubble and get people out of the rubble and, you know, help to extricate the dead and pile them up and then go back to battery duty.
How did you handle that? Because you're a teenager. You're 15 years old. And, and here, I mean, you're confronted with all the horrors of war.
Yeah, that's, but, you know, you either handle it, like listening to the BBC was, if you had a radio that could get the BBC, and sometimes we heard people like to listen to jazz, and we said, don't do it, because if you get caught, the punishment is horrific. So you towed the line, more or less, you know, between academic studies in the interim, and they graded you, and they were tough on you, and then you got some short sleep, and then the alarm bells rang, and you went out to your battery position and did 2 or 3 hours during the attack, and then you went try to catch some more sleep, and then in the morning at 7 o'clock, the academic, you know, you were aroused, and you had to be washed and cleaned and sit in uniform, in you know, combat uniform, in a classroom and follow the instructions of your teachers.
Wow, what an existence! Were you scared? Were you frightened, or were you too young to know any better?
The scariest day was, up to this day, I never figured I was more scared than one day when the 8th Air Force didn't like the any aircraft batteries shooting at them, and they concentrated a couple of box cars, we call them box cars, you know, the formation of 40 B-17s and B-24s. They split them off and bombed our battery position, and the last minute, as the bomb carpet rolled toward us, the battery commander yelled in the system, "Take cover," and we scrambled on, you know, to dig with claw with our fingers into the dirt around us as the 500-pounders, exploding 500-pounders rolled toward us. I got injured by shrapnel and, you know, got my first similar to
like a Purple Heart for
Americans? Like the Purple Heart. Uh-huh. And then we got some extra rations for having been wounded, you know. And that attack was repeated the next day. By the end of that period, you know, I think we all knew what being scared meant and what really means, you know. And I think that was as personally as close as the war really ever came to me in a direct way, by seeing that ordnance roll toward you, exploding, and the sound was deafening, and you were just scared, you know.
I'm curious, at such a young age and dealing with that, being confronted with that and being unable to escape it, how did you handle it, get used to living with that? I mean, did you have a belief that something or someone would carry you through regardless, or how do you think you endured that?
I don't know. I think in the simple sense, you know, which that really doesn't explain it fully, I know, but survival, you know. You didn't want to die. So you did everything possible to stay alive. And that sort of carried on all through the war, you know, because survival became the utmost important thing in your life, you know, because you sure as hell didn't want to be dead.
Absolutely.
And the other element was that looming in the background was if you stepped out of line, the punishment was immediate and was worse than trying to survive, because they either immediately shipped you to the Eastern Front, which was the survival date at the Eastern Front was between 22 and 26 days, or they put you, if you really had stepped out of line, they might, the threat was always the guys in the black uniforms that put you against the wall and shoot you. You didn't entertain that type of thinking at all, you know. So survival and staying alive became the mantra of the day, you know.
No doubt about it. And I know how you feel about America now. You've made that very clear, and I know you'll continue to make it clear throughout this interview. But is it possible to go back to those days as a teenager when these American bombers, some of whom might be listening, we've had a lot of 8th Air Force guys on this show from a lot of different bomb groups, when they were basically trying to kill you and take out your position, I can't imagine you felt too fondly about them. Can you go back and remember what your perception of America was at that time?
No, not really, because it sounds stupid, maybe, but fighting day in, day out at the battery had become routine. So it became let's call it impersonal. Up there were the bombers, and you try to shoot them down as many and as possible. And that was really that all you were aiming at the time. The propaganda called them all terror bombers, eradicating the cities next to which we were based. We tried to do our part in preventing as much of the bombing as possible, while we became pretty quickly aware that whatever we did, it wasn't sufficient to protect the cities, you know, sure, that around which we were stationed, you know. Mm-hmm. Because the trucks came maybe the next morning, and you were loaded on and were sent into the city to help, as I said, dig out survivors or, you know, dig out the dead. I guess in the long run, time has sort of put a cover on all of that, because if you ask me to pick out a specific day other than the day where I told you that we were so scared, there's a term that I can't use on the air, you know, when you fudge your undies, let's put it in a decent way, that that sticks in your mind, and you wanted to stay alive. You know, that was really all that mattered in any form, shape, or way. As we had turned 16, they increased our detachment for flight training. We went to Czechoslovakia, which was still out of range of the Allied bomber missions at that time. And we went to get tow planes out of the Spanish Civil War that were towing our gliders up in the air. And if the flight instructor was comfortable with what you were doing in the glider, they said, now learn how to fly the tow plane. And then we were switched over. The instructor was sitting behind us with a paddle. And every time we made a mistake, he hit us with a paddle on the head until we did it correctly. And so that we learned to fly tow planes. And then after that segment of training was over, we went back to the battery. But at age, just as I was turning 17, the Air Force said, okay, come on board. It's time, you know, active duty.
The Luftwaffe.
Luftwaffe came, and then the Luftwaffe sent us on to advanced flight training, first in Arado 96s, and then we switched over to advanced training in Fokker Wolf 190s. Then we were sent off to a training squadron where we became wingmen for experienced fighter pilots. And they actively took us into the air to show us how to approach an active bomber stream. And that was then the next couple of months. We were taught different approaches, how to, you know, approach bomber streams. But in the end, then somebody in 44, somebody said, why the hell we keep training young guys into propeller planes? We need jet pilots. So then they took us, mostly the, I guess, the highly trained glider pilots, and said, you are the best qualified to learn how to fly jet planes.
So you were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, and then
let me cut you off right there, because we need to hit another break. But I think that's a great one to leave off on, because when we come back, we'll hear about this trailblazing work in jet airplanes that Mr. Bauer did nearly 70 years ago. We'll also eventually find out how he came to serve in the American Armed Forces many years later. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common: Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Every week on this show, I hear a story I've never heard before. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard a story quite like the one Harold Bauer is sharing with us today. Maybe you've met him. Maybe you know him as Hal over there in Atascadero. He'll be 85 in a few months. And he will be in Paso Robles September 29th at the air show put on by the Estrella Warbirds Museum and the Planes of Fame Museum from down south. Some great aircraft going to be flying that day. You can take some tours. You can see them up close, including a P-38, a B-25, even a flying wing, the predecessor of the B-2 bomber. So a lot to see there in Paso Robles, September 29th. And I have that information linked at kmjnow.com. You can also find some photos there of our guest today, Mr. Bauer, including one at age 15, manning an anti-aircraft battery in Berlin. You heard him discuss that and how he eventually got to fly and was training as a pilot when the Luftwaffe said, we need some jet pilots. Now, this is 1944, and 99.9% of Americans didn't even know there was such a thing as a jet plane. They've never heard of this before. What was the first you heard of this jet engine technology?
We heard of it when they sequestered us into a training unit. By that time, we had heard and seen at the training bases the Messerschmitt 262 twin engine fighter plane, which was in operation by that time from bases in north of Berlin and near Munich. We saw them come and go and take off and land, but we didn't have any experience or any, we didn't get near it until they formed a unit with us and said, we are now putting together a unit that is supposed to fly a new single engine jet fighter, which was developed in 74 days in 1944. And the first plane, the Heinkel 162, the first plane flew in December 1944. And they were assembling a highly trained glider pilots to learn how to fly the Heinkel 162. And they put us into a training unit. And first the show put us into a glider version to become familiar with the plane, how the cockpit looked, what instrumentation it had, and so forth. And then as the first planes were delivered, we then were assigned to a unit formed by the Heinkel Works on the Baltic for pilots that would take the planes from the production line, do the first roll tests with them, and then perform a short 15-20 minute program to make sure that the planes flying them would stay together, because they had quite a few planes falling apart where the wings didn't hold it. They were made out of plywood with a steel frame, main steel frame, but the most of the plane was plywood and cloth. So those planes we were to take from the production line, put them through field tests first, and then for flight tests. And if we succeeded in a flight test, then the inspector from the Air Force would come, put a stamp on it, said accepted, now deliver it to such and such base where they were assembling them to form fighter units. And one of them was near the Danish border at Lech, and one was outside Munich, where they were trying to, and one was north of Berlin at Parchim, where they were trying to put the new Heinkel 162 single-engine fighters into formations that would be used to defend the collapsing Reich.
And what was it like to fly? And people that, you know, maybe a lot of people are familiar with the ME-262, fewer are familiar with the HE-162 that, as you said, is a single jet engine. That engine's kind of strapped on the back of this airplane.
The engine was strapped on the top, very simple to put on top and take off for overhaul. Ducting was minimal. The cabling was less. But we had no power ejection seats at that time. They were installed when the planes were the cannons and the machine guns were installed, but not yet zeroed in and put into proper positioning. The ejection seats were also were coming out and to be installed at the actual bases where we delivered them. So for us, the drawback was that if something went wrong, bailing out was not an option, because if you pushed out, you were pushed against the big BMW engine right behind the cockpit.
Yeah, you'd get sucked right into that
turbine. And people said, well, roll it over. Well, guess what? When you roll it over, you get pushed against the same engine behind you upside down. So for us, there was always the unspoken warning, do not bail out. If something goes wrong, try to crash it.
And what was it like to fly?
You know, land it.
So you had flown gliders and you'd flown all these propeller planes, but the first time that you felt the power and the speed of that jet engine and that HE-162, what was that like for you?
Mind-boggling.
I bet.
I mean, all of a sudden you lifted off in seconds. You were at 5,000 feet, you know, and it rolled. It was not simple to fly, but what I try to tell people, if you are thoroughly familiar with high-performance gliders, flying itself becomes sort of like in the background. You knew how to fly, so you had to concentrate on the idiosyncrasies of the specific airplane. And since the Heinkel 162 was continuously upgraded, when they found new flaws, you know, they lengthened the fuselage, or the camber was changed, or the rudder was slightly changed. So the model, each model you flew was somewhat different from the one that you probably flew before or picked up before at the assembly plants. So we were shuttling between assembly plants. In my time, I was mostly picking up planes in the underground facilities at the Harz Mountains in the center of Germany, and picked them up there. And then after we were successful with the test flight, we were then told, deliver them to either to Parchim, Leck, and I never had to deliver one in the Munich area. So you shuttled between assembly plants, and whenever one was coming out ready, you put it through the paces. As you flew more and more, you know, every time you flew one, you became a little more familiar with it, the characteristics it showed in flight, landing and takeoff, and then you adjusted your skills toward what that plane was doing and what you were supposed to be doing with a plane.
I mean, you're 17 years old, you're flying something that most of the world doesn't even know exists. And as you say, you know, for most of this time, there's no chance of ejection. You're trapped in it if something goes wrong. Did you ever feel like a guinea pig, or that you were expendable?
No, again, you know, survival. You know, you if you take off in it, the important thing that you land in it. And the difficulty in 1945, in January and February, we needed at least a short plowed runway. So what they did is they plowed the runway, and the snow masses on the right side and left side pretty quickly turned to ice barriers. So if we saw some people that in the takeoff didn't follow a straight line and ran into the ice mountain on the side, and poof, you know, the sweeper truck came, picked up the remains of the pilot and what was once an aircraft, and the same thing on landing. So you concentrated very much on straight takeoff and straight landing, so you didn't veer out of those narrow tunnels, let's say, you know.
Wow, I really can't imagine, and I can't believe that we're already out of time on this program. So everybody listening, I think, has already figured out we're not going to finish this story on this edition of Hometown Heroes. You're going to have to tune in again next week to hear the rest of Mr. Bauer's story. And that's perfect, because the following week, on September 29th, is when you can meet him in person there in Paso Robles at the air show. So tune in next week. And in the meantime, go to kmjnow.com to learn a little more about him, see some of the photos of his time in World War II and beyond. Then you'll be ahead of the game for the rest of the story next week. We're going to hear about how he was shot down in one of those jet airplanes that the Germans had engineered, how he got to know America a little better, and eventually flew for the Americans in the Korean War and served in our intelligence community, you name it. Quite a story that you're going to hear the rest of next week. It's Hometown Heroes on KMJ.